Please turn in your Bible once again to Luke chapter 16. Today we're looking at the parable of the unjust steward. There are several other ways I suppose we could look at this or title this as well. Over the last several months, a rather obscure Latin phrase has become much more common within our language, and that's the little phrase quid pro quo. Have you heard that in the news recently? Quid pro quo? The phrase literally means something for something. I will do something for you if you do something for me. People engage in quid pro quos all the time and in many different contexts. I'm told even that sometimes politicians even engage in quid pro quos. I don't really know about that, but that's what I'm told. In the parable we're looking at today, Jesus gives an example of an unjust steward who uses a quid pro quo for his own benefit. He does a favor for some people in the hopes that they will do a favor for him. Well, we're in a section of Luke that includes several parables. Today's parable is often called the parable of the unjust steward. But it is a rather unusual and difficult parable in that Jesus uses kind of a bad example to teach a good lesson. The unjust steward is just that. He's unjust. He's kind of a crook. He commits an act of fraud, and yet Jesus uses him as an example for us to follow. So that's kind of an unusual situation. Well, in order to understand the parable, we have to know what a steward is. And it's a word that we typically don't use very often. We would typically say maybe a manager or maybe an administrator, somebody like an accountant who takes care of other people's property. That's what a steward basically is, somebody who takes care of somebody else's business or somebody else's property. And typically a rich person would not take care of his own property. He would hire somebody to watch over his affairs so he would be free to do other things. Well, it seems like that's what this man is. He's a steward managing somebody else's property. And even though he's unjust, he does something that is very shrewd or something that's very good that Jesus commends the man for or uses him in this story to show a good lesson. So it's kind of interesting that he uses a bad example to teach a good lesson. One of the remarkable characteristics of parables is that they teach by use of memorable and sometimes surprising or shocking language. So it is rather a difficult parable to interpret. In fact, one of the commentators I was reading said this is the most difficult of all of Jesus' parables to interpret. I don't know if that's true, but it is a somewhat of a difficult one to understand and try to unwind and explain. So let's look at the text. We know the story. If you're listening along or reading along as we read through the story, the unjust steward was accused of wasting his master's good, his employer's goods, and it was true. He had wasted the monies, apparently, or squandered some of the resources. So he goes about trying to figure out what he's going to do. He recognizes that the writing is on the wall. He's about to lose his job. But while he's still the steward, he thinks about what he can do to try to provide a place for himself when he gets fired. He's going to get kicked out the door. He's going to get the pink slip. But until he does so, he has to figure out some way of doing something to provide another job for himself. So what does he do? He calls in those who are indebted to his employer, and he reduced the amounts of material that they owed to the employer. The debtors, of course, would have appreciated what he did for them. He reduced their bills substantially. He gave them a big discount on what they owed. He did them a big favor. So the hope was, of course, that if he did the favor for these people who owed his employer, once he gets kicked out, they would do a big favor for him. Maybe hire him as their steward or give him some sort of a place to stay for a little while or somehow take care of him because they recognize that he did them kind of a big favor in reducing what they owed. So we might call this, I think, truly a quid pro quo. I will do something for you in the hopes that you will do something for me. Jesus is obviously not suggesting that we cheat our employers in the hopes that we'll get a good job from somebody else who has benefited from our corruption. That is oftentimes the way the world works, but it's not the way that Christians are supposed to behave. Jesus is not overturning thousands of years of biblical morality and Christian ethics in saying that, oh, now it's okay to cheat your employer as long as you're going to get something out of the bargain. He's merely using a character from a fictional story to make a point about being astute or shrewd in the use of our resources and how we prepare for the future. The unjust steward shows us the importance of using present opportunities to provide for future needs. So the guy is thinking to the future, what resources do I have now that I can use, even though in the story's case it's the employer who has these resources, but what can I do now to set myself up for the future? And the goodness or the shrewdness here is what Jesus is pointing out. He made a wise decision in providing something for himself for the future. So how do we use God's resources for good purposes? All of us are stewards. All of us have things that God has provided for us. And we ought to be thinking, what can I do for the future to provide for myself and to use these resources in a way that would be honoring to God? How do we use present opportunities to meet or provide for future needs? Well, there are several things that he gives us here, several points that we might take into consideration. First of all, try to be at least as wise as the children of this world. Notice what he says in verse 8. The Lord commended the unjust steward because he had done wisely, for the children of this world are in their generation wiser than the children of light. So try to be at least as wise as the children of this world. That would be unsaved people. You know, the people out in the world, businessmen, try to be at least as shrewd as they are. How do we know that he's not commanding us here to follow the bad example of the unjust steward? How do we know that we're not supposed to be fraudulent? Well, obviously, he's the unjust steward. Jesus describes the man as unjust. We find out earlier in the story here that he had been wasting his employer's goods. And then, of course, he is categorized, you might say, as one of the children of the world. So clearly, Jesus is not saying, in your job, commit fraud for your own benefit. Obviously, he's not saying that. Jesus is simply using the steward as an example of how people in this world know how to work the system for their own benefit. They know how the world works, and they know how to take advantage of that system for themselves. And so somebody put it this way, I think this is a good description. The dishonest manager had not done a good thing, but he had been careful to plan ahead using material things to ensure a secure future. Jesus was not teaching his disciples to be dishonest. He was teaching that we should use material things for future spiritual benefit. This was a good lesson from a bad example. And so I think that's the primary thing that we take away from this parable. Use the things that you have now for the benefit for yourself and for the Lord into the future. Interestingly, the Lord or the employer in the example or in the story here in this parable commended the unjust steward for his shrewd choices. He said, "You have done wisely." Instead of rebuking his steward for his corrupt scheme, he commends him. In fact, the word there is to praise. He praised his unjust steward. Now, if you were the employer, would you praise your employee for wasting your goods and then giving a big discount? Obviously, he's not commending him for wasting his goods or being fraudulent, but he is commending him, he's praising him here, for being shrewd in a kind of a worldly way. You know how the world works, you know how to get a favor from somebody, and so you work the system for your own benefit, which was kind of a shrewd, kind of a calculated thing to do. And so the employer here kind of praises him for that. So that's the connection that we're looking at, the connection between the unjust steward and us, is shrewdness or forethought in using our resources to provide for future needs. All of us face an uncertain future. We don't know if we're going to get sacked or, you know, we don't know if we're going to lose our job. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And so it's wise to prepare for the future. It's wise to use the resources we have for future possibilities, not only for ourselves, but also for the Lord and for his work and for his program in the world. So notice again, verse 8, he said in the second half of the verse, the children of this world are in their generation wiser than the children of light. He's making a distinction between the people out in the world, the people, the children of this generation would be unsaved people, people just out in the world, people who don't know the Lord. And they live in a certain way that is wise. They take care of themselves. They know how to work the system. They know how to prepare for the future. And they do it better than believers do. Christians tend not to be very smart sometimes in the use of their resources. They fail to use their resources to prepare for the future. But like the unjust steward was shrewd in his plan for the future, Christians should also be shrewd in our plans for the resources that we have to take care of ourselves and to take care of the work of the Lord. So how do we do that? How do we make a shrewd plan? How do we take care of our resources so we have something into the future? Well, he's about to tell us in verse 9. He says, I say unto you, make to yourselves friends of the mammon of unrighteousness, that when ye fail, they may receive you into everlasting habitations. Now, that's how the King James puts it. I guess I don't know how other translations might put it. Maybe they smooth it out a little bit. But just looking at that language, there are several things about that statement or about that verse that are somewhat hard to understand. And so we need to look at each one of these phrases to try to figure out what the author is talking about. He says, make to yourselves friends of the mammon of unrighteousness. What in the world is the mammon of unrighteousness? Well, the word mammon is an old Aramaic term that means money or possessions. So if you think of worldly wealth, the wealth that people out in the world are pursuing, the money that you're paid, money in the bank, money in your wallet, valuable possessions, that's mammon. Now, why would Jesus describe money or wealth as unrighteous? Well, what does Paul tell us about the love of money? The love of money is the what? Root of all evil, root of all kinds of evil. Do you know that in the, at least in the King James Version, four times the Bible refers to money as filthy lucre? What does that say about money? Well, money is closely associated with what? Sin. How much sin is done either with money or for money? Either because you have money or to get money. There's a lot of sin connected with money or material possessions or valuable things. That's why Jesus describes it as unrighteous mammon. Worldly goods, valuable things, often are associated with sin in the life of ungodly people. So, in a certain sense, money is dirty or it's unrighteous because of the sin that's connected to it oftentimes. So he says, make to yourselves friends of the mammon of unrighteousness. So I think what he's talking about here is probably best understood by the culture in which he lived. In the Roman culture of Jesus' day, giving and receiving money and gifts was a normal way of making or strengthening relationships. How did you make a friend? How do you strengthen relationships? How do you maybe tie yourself to another person or make another person obligated to you? Well, it was typically through gifts or money. Those who receive the money feel obligated to do something kind to the one who gave it. Now, we may not put it in those terms, but oftentimes if we are generous to others, we kind of expect them to be generous to us. We did something nice for somebody else. It's just kind of human nature to think that they're going to turn around and do something nice for us. There's nothing really sinful about that. It's just the way the world works, the way that humans work as well. So what happens when we make friends with unrighteous mammon? He goes on to say in verse 9, that when ye fail, they may receive you into everlasting habitations. The word fail here has a sense of ceasing or stopping or quitting something. So when it fails, when the money fails, I think is what he's talking about. When you run out of valuables, when you no longer have an income, when you get, you know, put out of your job, when you are on skid row, well, a crisis has happened. So you need somebody to help you out, somebody who's going to bail you out when you go bankrupt. Who's going to help you when the money stops flowing? Who's going to help you when you no longer have a job? Well, it's the friends that you have that you've made through your generosity. You've been generous to other people in their time of need, and now when your time of need comes up, people are going to be helpful or generous to you because you helped them out. You bailed them out, and now you kind of expect, well, when that happens to me, other people are going to bail me out. Now, probably the most difficult part of this whole situation here is found in the next part at the end of verse 9, that they may receive you into everlasting habitations. You'd be surprised at how many interpretations of this little part of the sentence exist out there. Who are the they, that they may receive you into everlasting habitations? Well, I think he's talking about the friends that you've made by being generous with your resources, okay? The unjust steward made friends through his resources, although it was the fraudulent use of resources, but he made friends with the unrighteous mammon that he had. And so the result was that those who benefited from his friendship would take him into their home when his current employer kicked him out. Now, what in the world does it mean by everlasting habitations? Well, the word habitation is literally tents. So I think he's talking about the homes of his friends, that they would receive you into their homes when your money fails. I don't believe he's talking here about heaven. Sometimes we might think, well, an everlasting habitation must be heaven. But the problem is, remember, he's talking about entering the everlasting habitation through the use of money. And we all know that you don't buy your way into heaven. No amount of money can get you into heaven. You can't buy entrance into heaven. And it's really also not our friends who welcome us into heaven. Sometimes you might think that, well, when we get to heaven, our friends will be there to welcome us. But biblically speaking, there's nothing that says your friends are the one who receive you into heaven. The Bible talks about God and Christ receiving you when you get to heaven, but there's nothing that says your friends are going to welcome you into heaven. So I think his point seems to be that the friends you've made through your generosity will open their homes to you in your time of need. You've been generous to them, and now when you have a time of need, they're going to be generous to you. Now, some people might look at that very cynically and say, well, you're just buying your friends. You know, and I suppose there are some people who do that. They flash around their money. They are generous to their friends because, you know, they're trying to buy off friendships. I suppose that may be true. But just practically speaking, we all realize that when you are generous to others, others tend to be generous to you. I mean, that's just normal human tendencies, I suppose. And so it's not so much that we're trying to buy friendships with the use of our resources. It's more like we see somebody else in need, we help them out, we're generous toward them, and then if something terrible or tragic happens to us, we kind of expect others to help us out in our time of need as well. Somebody put it this way, Jesus knows the evil power in money, but servants of God have to use it for the kingdom of God. They should use it discreetly, and it is proper to make friends by the use of it. So if you are generous to others, others will be generous to you. If you've used your resources to care for others in their time of need, you can expect others to care for you in your time of need. Well, let's go on to see what else he says here about the proper use of our resources to prepare for the future. He says in verse 10, "He that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much, and he that is unjust in the least is unjust also in much." So one of the clear principles here is that we have to take care of the things that we have, be a good steward, be careful in the use of the things that God has given us, even the small details of life. Be careful, be faithful in the small things. Years ago when I was in the military, in boot camp, they taught us how to do really small detailed things like how to fold our shirts in the proper way and how to make our beds in the proper way, you know, with those hospital corners, and how to arrange everything in our foot lockers, and it had to be in a certain way. And I think the principle that they were teaching was, if you can't handle a little detail like folding your t-shirt, you certainly can't handle a multi-million dollar piece of equipment, let's say on an aircraft or, you know, whatever you're working on. You have to be able to do the small details of life, and if you can't handle the small details, nobody's going to give you bigger responsibilities. Well, that's sort of what he's saying here. Be careful, be faithful with the small things, and if you are, then you'll inherit more. You'll get more responsibilities. How you handle the mundane details of life reflects your inner character. What you do with the things that you have says a lot about who you are. And how you handle your responsibilities, even though it might seem like a minor detail of life, how you handle those things is important. So money, I think, is an example of that which is least. He's talking here about the mammon of unrighteousness, and then he that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in that which is greater. So I think what he's talking about here is the use of our money, even though it may seem like a large thing, handling money, managing our, you know, resources, taking care of our finances, that might seem like a big thing, but in reality, it's, I think, what he's calling here a small thing. At least it should be a small thing for us. Money should not be the central focus of our lives. Spiritual things and good character are far greater value than money is. But how you use money says a lot about who you are as a person. And how you use money can have eternal consequences. What we do with our money can be either a waste, like the unjust steward was guilty of, wasting his resources or the resources of his employer, or it can be something that will have eternal value. If you're faithful in small things like money, it's most likely that you'll be faithful in large, important things. What you do with small things, your responsibility over small things, reflects the kind of person you are. It tells us a lot about your character. Legend has it that Abe Lincoln earned the name Honest Abe back in 1831 when he was a store clerk in New Salem, Illinois. When he walked 5 miles to return 6 pennies worth of change to a woman he had accidentally overcharged. Now, most of us probably wouldn't walk 5 miles to return 6 pennies. I don't know what 6 pennies would be valued today, maybe $6. Would you walk 5 miles to return $6 worth of money that you overcharged mistakenly? Well, Honest Abe was known to be honest because he recognized that he needed to put that little item right and was willing to walk a long ways to return 6 pennies. Well, that's a good example of being faithful in small things. If you can't be trusted to take care of a little bit of change, well, it's highly unlikely that you could be trusted to take care of thousands or millions of dollars worth of valuable goods. So we have to be trustworthy in small things. Notice verse 11. Likewise, he says, if therefore you have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, money, valuables, who will commit to your trust the true riches? So be faithful regarding the unrighteous mammon, worldly goods, and maybe someone will entrust you with things that are more important. What would be the true riches if the mammon of unrighteousness is worldly goods, money, finances, valuables, things you can see and feel and touch and buy? What would be the true riches? Well, that would be, I think, things that cannot be bought and sold. Things like reputation or love or friendship or trust or responsibility. If you can't handle a minor thing like money, well, then you probably can't be trusted with higher responsibilities. You might think that smaller things are really not too important. I don't really need to be faithful. I don't need to be careful with small things. I'm careful about big things. I can handle big responsibilities, but little responsibilities, I don't really care so much about those things. But really, what you do, how you handle the little things, is a reflection of who you are as a person. And frankly, if I had an employee who couldn't handle little minor details, I would never entrust him with bigger details. And that's one of the things I think that younger people need to learn and understand is, if you can't be trusted to, you know, clean your room, and you can't be trusted to take care of a dollar that's entrusted to you, and you can't be trusted to obey your parents when they tell you what to do, why would they ever give you greater responsibilities, or you might say greater privileges? You know, you want to have certain thing, maybe whatever, something that's going to require a great deal of responsibility, but you can't even take care of a little thing. Well, if you want greater responsibility, greater privileges, you have to earn them. At least that's the way it works in my family. That's the way it works out in a lot of families. You have to prove yourself. And so in order to prove yourself, what do? You take care of the little things. You do the small, detailed things that don't really seem to matter all that much. Like in the military, folding your t-shirt to make sure the seams line up at the right place. How important is that? It's ridiculous. It's stupid. It means nothing. But if you can't do it the way that they want you to do it, if you can't follow that order, then you just can't follow orders. And nobody's going to entrust you greater responsibilities. So, you know, we need to be faithful in those small things. Be faithful and careful, really, with every responsibility that's entrusted to us. We need to try to be faithful and careful. And then verse 12, he says, if you've not been faithful in that which is another man's, who shall give you that which is your own? So again, if you want to have your own property, you want to have your own things, well, you know, you work up to that. You earn the privilege to have the things that you have, and so be faithful in the small things. Somebody said many years ago, take care of the pennies and the pounds will take care of themselves. And so be faithful in the small things. And then finally, verse 13, no servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. Serve God with your resources. We have to be careful not to be enslaved by mammon. We must resist the power of mammon and worldly goods. You may remember a commercial that was on TV a few years ago. A man introduces himself as Stanley Johnson. He has a wonderful family, a nice big house and a beautiful community. He drives a new car, and he even is a part of the local golf club. How does he do it? He says, I'm in debt up to my eyeballs. He can barely pay for his finance charges. At the end of the commercial, he's riding on his lawnmower, and he says, can somebody help me? You get the sense that he has everything that he wants, but how did he get it? Through borrowing money. And he's in debt, as he says, up to his eyeballs. So Stanley is enslaved by his possessions. There's nothing necessarily wrong with having those possessions, but to be enslaved by them, to be serving mammon, that's a very good example of being a servant of the things that you own. If we have to choose between God or mammon, which should we choose? Which is a better master, God or material possessions? We can't put both first, so we have to make a choice. Who are we going to serve? And obviously we ought to serve God and not the things that we own. We use money either faithfully or unfaithfully. Either we have control of it or it has control of us. Either it serves us or we serve it. And it really doesn't matter whether you have a lot or a little. You could be poor as a church mouse and still be the servant of mammon. You could be a very rich individual and still be the servant of mammon. You could be somewhere in between and still serve mammon. You can have, certainly, both God and money, but you can't serve both God and money. You have to put one or the other first. You can't serve two masters. And if God is not first in your life, well, what does that make you? That makes you an idolater. Idolatry is putting something else first besides God. It doesn't mean that we can't have and enjoy the things that God provides, but it does mean that ultimately speaking, it can't be money, can't be valuable possessions, it can't be our bank account or our wallet that is first. There's got to be God who is first in the life of the believer. So we need to have money, we need to use money, we need to have resources, but ultimately speaking, it's a minor thing. It's a secondary, third, fourth, fifth down the list of the things that we're concerned about. It is a major responsibility, but it's not as important as serving God. So the challenge here is that we make the right choices with our resources. And if we're really serving God, then what do we do with our resources? We use them for the glory of God. We use them for the benefit of ourselves and our family, but ultimately speaking, we submit our resources to God for His use. The way to be free from covetousness and greed is to put God first. He has to be the master and the Lord of all things, including our finances. Christ is calling us to submit our financial resources to the will of God and to His purposes in the world. So the point of all this is that God expects us as His stewards to use the resources He has entrusted us for good purposes. Worldly people know how to use their money for their own purposes, and Christians should know how to use money for godly, spiritual, and eternal purposes. What we have is not our own. The Bible says everything is God's. The world, the earth, everything in it belongs to the Lord, and He has given some of it to us. We are not owners of anything. We are stewards. We're managers, and it's a blessing to be able to use the resources that God puts in our hands. But we have to recognize that it comes from God. God entrusts it to us, and we need to use those resources for godly purposes. So plan ahead. Be shrewd and astute. Follow the example of this unjust steward, not in the unjustness, not in the wastefulness, not in the fraud that he committed, but in the shrewdness, in the planning, in the thinking ahead of using resources so he will be taken care of in the future. We can put unrighteous mammon to good use. Jesus does not condemn us for possessing worldly wealth, but He just wants to make sure that we're using our things appropriately for the right purposes. The danger is that we use our financial resources for ourselves and not for God. We perhaps even justify the spending of our money on ourselves. Well, we can afford to get the things that we want, but then when it comes to God's purposes for our money, when it comes to supporting the things of God, you know, the church and missionaries and needy people and other good causes and things that we could support, all of a sudden we find that we can't afford that. We have it in the budget to take care of what we want, but perhaps we don't have it in the budget to take care of the things that God wants. And so this is being shrewd or being careful is making sure we're using our resources for the things that God wants for His glory and for His purposes. God owns everything, and the money in our wallets and in our bank accounts is His. Our job is to be responsible managers. That's the idea of a stewardship. Be responsible managers over what God entrusts to us. We ought to use our master's money faithfully and employ it for eternal purposes. And I'll close with a quote, which I thought was a very good way to finish up the message this morning. You need to ask yourself, am I living as a faithful steward, shrewdly using the resources God has entrusted to me to lay up treasures in heaven? Or have I slipped into squandering God's resources for my own purposes, losing sight of the fact that eternity is quickly approaching? I urge you to learn the lesson from this scoundrel, the unjust steward. Invest your master's money in that which will pay eternal dividends. Well, on that note, let's close.